start with our motivation. So today was a big day at the Abbey and a big day for the creation of a lot of merit, a lot of virtue. And during an ordination ceremony, you have to remain incredibly focused. You can't space out for a moment. So it keeps your mind in a virtuous space by that force. And then afterwards, you feel quite good. So I think, I hope everybody feels that way this evening and can really see for your own experience how subduing the mind and keeping the mind in a constructive state, in a virtuous state, is the cause of happiness now and, of course, in the future as well. And so especially when we have the bodhicitta motivation and we're doing things with that motivation and a far-reaching intention, then all the cares of this life just evaporate because they aren't important anymore. And the mind takes great delight on doing what is really important in the long term for the benefit of all beings. And so cultivating that bodhicitta motivation again, then let's listen to the teachings. Does everybody feel happy this evening? Yeah? Nice, huh? And so all of you who cooked and prepared, thank you very much. You know, there's something, isn't there? You know, sometimes we say, oh, rituals, ceremonies. I used to think like, they're so dry, so boring. Everybody's just saying all this stuff. Repetition. You know, but you can see, maybe if we did this every day, it would be different. But, you know, in doing an ordination ceremony, it's like everybody's really present and you really feel the goodness involved in the, you know, everybody there changing their mind and putting their mind in the Dharma. You know, it's not just the person who gets ordained, but it's the Sangha, the preceptor, the acharya, the witnesses, you know, everybody is changing their mind and putting their mind in a good direction. And I don't know if you noticed, I mean, I'm probably more familiar with the ceremony than many of the others of you, but you may notice that although this is a ceremony for taking the monastic precepts, which are on the level of the fundamental vehicle. They aren't a bodhisattva practice. You may have noticed in the ceremony how often things about bodhicitta and compassion come in. Yeah, there's little phrases here and there. And so you can see, you know, when we were speaking with Venerable Wu Yin in 96 in for the Life as a Western Buddhist Nun program, she commented that one of the reasons the Chinese chose the Dharmaguptaka system was because it fits so well with the Bodhisattva vehicle. You know, even though it's a fundamental vehicle ordination, it fit very well, you know, with the Bodhisattva practice. So you could really see that in the ceremony. Mm-hmm. We're going to continue going on with the Bodhisattva precepts. We finish number 9 and number 10, right? So we're starting then with 11. Okay. Yeah, so that one of holding, it's very interesting with each of these two, to go through them, you know, as you go back and contemplate them, and say, why is this particular action antithetical to the bodhisattva motivation or to bodhisattva actions? Yeah. So you could see, especially number 9, holding wrong views, which is a very serious one. I mean, that's completely, how could you even be practicing the Dharma if you're holding wrong views, let alone the, you know, following the bodhisattva path. And number 10, destroying towns, villages, cities, and so on. Similarly, that certainly would be something a bodhisattva would do, you know. And then number 11, teaching emptiness to those whose minds are unprepared. Okay, so unprepared means someone whose mind is unprepared means somebody who hasn't heard the basic teachings of precious human life, death, refuge, karma, you know, the four truths of the Aryas, you know, something about bodhicitta. In other words, this person does not have a grounding in the Buddha's teachings on conventionalities and conventional truth. And so especially if they don't have a strong grounding in karma and its effects, then some people, if they learn emptiness and they misunderstand it, then they think that emptiness means nothing exists, and then they think karma and its effects don't exist, and therefore there's no reason to keep ethical conduct. And with that kind of wrong view, then they throw ethical conduct to the wind and wind up creating the cause for an unfortunate rebirth. Okay, so that's the reason why. So it isn't that, oh, emptiness is a secret teaching, or it's a high teaching, or this or that. It's just because it's easy for somebody who doesn't have sufficient grounding to misunderstand it, you know? So, for example, in the emptiness meditation where you start asking, how does the I exist? Is it one and the same as the aggregates, or is it totally separate from the aggregates? And somebody could look and say, well, it's not one with the aggregates. It's not totally separate from the aggregates. Those are the only two choices. So the I doesn't exist at all. Now, the thing is, those are the only two choices if the I existed inherently. But if the I exists conventionally, there is another choice, which is that the I exists dependent on the aggregates. Yeah, it's not totally one and identical with them. It's not totally separate. It's dependent. But somebody who, you know, doesn't understand this, then just says, well, it's not one, it's not different. There's no I, you know. And if there's no I, then there's no one who creates karma, so there's no karma, so I can do whatever I want, okay? And that's a very, very dangerous view, because with that view, it gives the person permission to follow whatever idea pops in their mind without stopping to think, is this something virtuous or non-virtuous? Yeah. Okay, because karma doesn't exist, so, you know, everything's empty, everything's non-existent. Yeah. So that gives them permission. So it's very, very dangerous, yeah. Nagarjuna spoke about this in chapter 1 of Precious Garland. You know, again, how it's easy for people to fall to this kind of extreme. So as somebody who is teaching, you know, whenever you're teaching, you have to be very aware about who your audience is, you know. And if it's people who are brand new, then, you know, you really have to give them the teachings on you know, the conventional truth, meaning, you know, renunciation, bodhicitta, these kinds of things, not go into a teaching on emptiness. Yeah. Sometimes you can hint around about emptiness or bring a little bit in here or there. Yeah, but you don't want to go full force into it because, you know, it could be dangerous for the other person. Yeah. And even people who have heard a lot of teachings can sometimes misunderstand too. Yeah. And it's, you know, because also too, they say, you know, the story about the one who grabs his donka and says, am I still here? Yeah, that happens when you get an inferential realization of emptiness, you know. So even at that point, there, you know, the emptiness is so vastly different than how we look at things now that, you know, even for that person, they're going, does anything exist? And they, you know, yank on her. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Any questions? You get the reason why for that? Uh-huh.
A lot of people seem to, when they're first hearing about emptiness, doze off or something. I wonder if that's a self-protection mechanism.
Oh, it might be. Yeah. Yeah.
But just not being prepared, I suppose.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, people fall asleep in teachings for even not teachings on emptiness, even something that they could understand if they were awake. Yeah. Okay, number 12, causing those who have entered the Mahayana to turn away from working for the full awakening of Buddhahood and encouraging them to work merely for their own liberation from suffering. Okay, so here's somebody who has entered the Bodhisattva path, you know, in terms of having faith in it, following it, doing the bodhisattva practices. And then we come along and say, why are you doing that? You know, why are you practicing the Mahayana? It's unrealistic. Yeah? You want to enlighten all sentient beings? Yeah. You can't do that. There's so many Buddhas already, they can't do it. Huh? So why are you exerting all this effort? And it takes so long to do the Mahayana path. Better, it's much shorter, less merit, less time to become an arhat following the Shravaka path. So do that. Yeah? And then somebody could think about it and go, well, yeah, there's already all these Buddhas, so well, I don't need to do it. And it's true, it takes three countless great eons. That's really a long time. And, you know, let's get myself out of samsara first, because after all, you know, if I'm not out of samsara, I can't benefit anybody anyway. And so then they give up the bodhicitta and give up the bodhisattva path and practice the path to arhatship. Okay? So it's not that the path to arhatship is bad. Arhats are much more highly realized than we are. Okay, so don't disparage arhats. That's not a wise thing to do. Yeah? But it's just if somebody has entered the Mahayana path and has that inclination and has started to follow it, then turning them away from it is actually harmful to all sentient beings, because it means it's going to take that person much longer to become a Buddha, because they'll go through the whole arhat path, spend a while, a few eons in meditation on emptiness, and then have to go back and start the bodhisattva path, the path of accumulation. Okay, so it takes longer for that person to get to enlightenment, which is not so good for all the sentient beings who have karma with that person, who that person could benefit if they were a Buddha. Okay? So that's why we don't do that. You know, it's discouraging the people from it. Yeah? So it could be in different ways. You could say the goals to high, you know, Buddhahood, that's too high, too hard, omniscient, you know, kind of just, you trash the goal, or disparaging the path. Bodhisattva path is so difficult. You have to give your body, you have to, you know, give up all your own pleasure, you have to work for sentient beings, even in the hell realm, you know, and they're so ungrateful, so, you know, don't waste your time on those beings. So saying the path is too hard. Or it could be saying that the person who's the basis, you know, of practicing, oh, you know, you just don't have what it takes to become a bodhisattva. You know, you're not smart enough. You don't have enough compassion. Okay, so disparaging either the basis, the person, or the path, or the result. Yeah, and in that way, talking somebody out of following the bodhisattva path. So we don't want to do that. So, yeah, I mean, when I was in Thailand, a few of the very, the Western monks, there was one Western monk especially, yeah, and he, what are you doing? Three, yeah. And then there were other of the monks that came and said, tell us more about your practice. Of course I told them. I was talking bodhicitta surreptitiously every opportunity I had. Okay, then, so anything about this one at all? Okay, then we'll go to 13. So causing others to abandon completely their precepts of self-liberation and embrace the Mahayana. Okay, so 12 was causing somebody to give up the Mahayana and practice the fundamental vehicle. Here, you're talking to somebody who's practicing the Vinaya, you know, those are called the precepts of self-liberation because the basic foundation motivation for taking them is a wish for your own personal liberation, okay? So somebody who has those precepts and then discouraging them from keeping, let's say, their ordination, their monastic precepts, and instead embracing the Mahayana instead, okay? So this could be the same thing. Kind of, what's the use of being a monastic? You know, come on, that's a, you know, I've heard this. You know, this is people, it's 2,500 years ago they were doing that. And we're in the modern age now. And you guys are celibate? That's nutty. You're suppressing your sexuality. You know, forget about you're not enjoying life. You're not, it's true, you're not enjoying life. And, you know, no, I can't do this. No, I can't do that. But you're actively suppressing your sexuality, and that's totally unhealthy. You know? So it's not natural. You need to go have a relationship. And relationships are really good on the path. When you are in a relationship, you have to give up your own self-centeredness. Because you're sitting, you know, if you're going to make your marriage go. And children are experts at making you get rid of your self-centeredness as a parent. Because you have to wake up in the middle of the night and feed them. And you have to go to work and you have to put up with them when there's yelling and screaming. And so let me tell you, family life will get you to enlightenment much quicker, you know. That this monastic thing is old-fashioned. Yeah, you're copying out. Yes, oh, and this is the big thing. Yeah, it's because you can't have a relationship. You've tried and you've had failed relationships. Yeah, you've been divorced, you've been in love, and they've rejected you. So you're a failure at relationships, and so that's why you want to become ordained. This is a big thing in Asia, what they say, what their image of monastics, especially nuns. You know, the nuns are the old maids who couldn't find some rich, handsome guy to marry. Yeah. And so, you know, they say, better you give up your monastic life and practice the Mahayana. Anyway, Mahayana is faster. The Bodhisattva precepts are a higher level of ordination than the Pratimoksha precepts. So why keep the Pratimoksha when you can keep the Bodhisattva? You, and bodhicitta, you accumulate more merit having that. So, you know, just give back your robes, have a nice wardrobe, let your hair grow out. When you go to the disco, you can meet so many people and talk Dharma there to them. You know? And in the pub, I mean, all the people in the pub are suffering so much. And you can go to the pub and talk the Dharma to them. And in that way, you could spread Dharma so well, you know, where as if you're one of these stodgy monastics. You know, you certainly can't go into the pub and do that. Yeah, so get with it if you want to benefit sentient beings. Yeah? Any of you ever had somebody say something like that to you? Huh? I've heard it.
I mean, I don't speak for myself, but this person said, oh, you are so attractive, and well, how can you do that? No, don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when I, in Dharamsala, when I went into the fabric shop down in Lower Dharamsala to get my robes, you know, I was buying to get the cloth for my robes. And this one man looked at me and said, what a pity, you know, you're so pretty. You should really get married, not become a nun. What? I'm not pretty, and I don't want to get married. Yeah. Kind of like, oh, there's an attractive sex object. What a misfortune that nobody gets to. Yeah. Yes.
Remember Venerable Chuan Guan used to say, you know, that when they said to the people, you're only a monastic because your relationships have failed, right? Then he would say, oh, what's wrong with that? But he said, many people have failed relationships and they go out and kill people. or get drunk and do all kinds of crazy things. He said, it's very good. You failed in a relationship. You became a nun or a monk. Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, he's right, really, because many people go out and get drunk and then drive when they're drunk and do all sorts of nutty things when their relationships break up. Yeah. Very true.
It's a rationalization, obviously, because when you become a monastic, talking from someone who's just looking at the team, it seems like you have way more relationships than I do.
I was wondering if this could also be disparaging the five lay vows.
It could be too. Yeah, you know, if you have a lay person who has taken all five precepts, and then their friends want to take them out to drink, or somebody's flirting with them and wants to have sex with them, and they say, "No, I have a precept," and then, you know, the friends go, oh, yeah, you don't take intoxicants, you know. You're one of those prudy Buddhists, you know. And then disparage everything. That's not very good.
Yeah, but even somebody that's encouraging them to take bodhisattva vows might be,
Yeah, you're disparaging one, encouraging them to take, But you can take the bodhisattva vows because, look, there's one bodhisattva vow that says that if it's for the benefit of all sentient beings, you don't need to keep the pratimoksha vows. Yeah? So, yeah, if you want to convert sentient beings in the pub, you got to go and be among them, and you're doing it with the bodhicitta motivation. Yeah? Right. Right. Yeah. That precept is so often misunderstood and used as a big rationalization, you know? Okay. So, you know, you we can see here from 12 and 13 that both keeping the monastic precepts and following the bodhisattva path, that both of those are important and that both of them can be done together in a complementary fashion. Yeah, that's the conclusion from these two precepts. So that you, yeah, that you can do both in a complementary fashion so that there's no need for us to have to doubt either our pratimoksha precepts or doubt our bodhisattva practice. Yeah, yeah. So this could also be, you know, what's the use of Vinaya? Mahayana is better. Yeah. Yeah. If you keep the pratimoksha is just, you know, one translation for it is, you know, the ethical restraints for individual liberation. You know, so somebody could say, oh, you keep those? That's just for your own personal liberation. That's very selfish. Yeah, you should practice Mahayana instead. Give that up and practice Mahayana instead, because then you're working for the benefit of others. Yeah, and that comes from somebody not understanding that the pratimoksha is the foundation of the bodhisattva practice, and that you can also keep the pratimoksha with a bodhicitta motivation. Okay, then 14. Holding and causing others to hold the view that the fundamental vehicle does not abandon attachment and other afflictions. Okay, so number 6, abandoning the holy dharma by saying that the texts that teach the three vehicles are not the Buddha's word. So that would be, for example, disparaging one of the fundamental vehicle scriptures and saying that they aren't the Buddha's word. 14 is talking about the practice, not the scriptures. Okay? And so 14 is saying that the fundamental vehicle practice doesn't work. Okay? So 6 is talking about the text and 14, the fundamental vehicle practice, okay? So saying that it doesn't abandon attachment and other afflictions. Now, why would somebody think that? Possibly, the only reason I can think is because there was, I think it was around the time of King Ashoka, so probably 3rd century BC, and there was a convocation or conference of the monastics, and there was this question brought up about, can you be an arhat and still have afflictions, or can you be an arhat and then fall back to samsara? So maybe somebody has that kind of view. Yeah. Or maybe it's just somebody who doesn't like the idea of having to give up attachment. Yeah? Well, that would, and so you say, well, you know, that vehicle doesn't really, you know, abandon attachment anyway, and I actually don't want to abandon my attachment, and so just forget the whole thing. Yeah, that's the only reason I can think of why somebody would think like that. I mean, all these things you can see come from people misunderstanding the teachings, either not having heard teachings and so not having the correct understanding, or having heard them but misunderstood. Yeah, or having somebody who, you know, yeah, like Nagarjuna says, one of the cows that's leading the others and, you know, leads you down the wrong path. Okay, then 15, falsely saying that you have realized profound emptiness and that if others meditate as you have, they will realize emptiness and become as great and as highly realized as you. Okay, so if you say this kind of thing and it's motivated by jealousy and attachment, then it could very well be the first root downfall, praising yourself. and belittling others. Okay? So especially the praising oneself part. I've realized emptiness. I see the ultimate nature. So if you're doing it out of jealousy and attachment in order to have more disciples, in order to get more offerings, then it's the first one, the first root downfall. Okay? And so it's also a form of lying. I mean, because this is talking about if you haven't realized emptiness, so it could be lying. And this precept specifies emptiness here, but it could be other realizations that you claim to have. Okay? You know, the animals talk to me, you know, like they talk to St. Francis, or, you know, I have psychic powers and I can see into the future and, you know, do this and that, or I can, you know, pass through walls or walk on water, or, you know, yeah. I have samadhi, I can have serenity, I've actualized the fourth jhana. So this is something where you know you haven't, and yet you claim you have. Okay? So it's kind of like the root precept that the monastics have of lying about realizations. Okay. So this one, you know, you can really see when you get put in a position of being the leader of a group or a teacher, if you have a lot of people around you who just think that you are fantastic, you know, and they worship you and they think you're so highly realized and so wonderful, yeah, then it's so easy, and especially I'm thinking of monastics, you know, when they're not living in a community. Yeah, it's one monastic living in a Dharma center with lay people, and the lay people just worship you and think you're wonderful. You have no other monastics around who kind of know who you really are. And who you do confession with. Yeah. But you have all these people just adoring you, and then you start to think, well, yeah, I am pretty good, you know. These people think that I'm really good, and they think my explanations on emptiness are really wonderful. They think that I must have realized it, you know. Maybe, yeah, you know, I do have some understanding of emptiness. It's pretty good. Yeah, maybe I do have an inferential realization. Yeah. Or whatever other kind of thing. You know, maybe all these people are saying I'm so kind, I'm a bodhisattva. Yeah? Because you have all these disciples that say, oh, you're so kind, like you have so much compassion. Yeah, maybe I am.
You and I have been practicing for a really long time, and we both have known people who've gone down that road. And so would you be kind enough to just say a few words about what really helps you not go down that road? Because you've been the Dharma teacher, the soul monastic for many, many years before you established this place. And certainly if you wanted to put yourself on a high throne, you could do it around here too. So
I'll sit on top of the table.
You know, and
my throne supported by four cats. Who needs slow snow lions when you can have cats? What? Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, I could sit on top of I think, I mean, I just look at my own mind. So, you know, it's like I just look at, you know, there's afflictions in my mind, so what am I going to do? Say I don't have afflictions? That would be ridiculous. Yeah? So I think if you just, you know, if you look at your mind at all and are at all even a little bit honest with yourself, then, you know, You don't go around proclaiming that kind of stuff. But, you know, yeah, I mean, we've seen people do that. Yeah. And then the disciples of those people are amazing, you know. They're all like, I remember being at one teaching, sitting near the disciples of one person who was like that, and like, oh, our teacher's, he's at least path of seeing, we're sure. He's just wonderful. I mean, I didn't say anything. I don't know somebody's level of realization, but I wasn't impressed.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that in response to your question and witnessing you mm-hmm. over the years, I've always thought that the thing that probably must have served you really well in this regard is the value of transparency. I mean, I've seen you mm-hmm. just, you know, admit to things when you can, when it's appropriate, that a lot of people wouldn't. So that mm-hmm. kind of is kind of not just honest to yourself, but you've been honest with others. And made that a priority for us as a community. Mm-hmm. And even before we were a community, it was a value. So I always thought that was probably mm-hmm. quite important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could be. Okay. But this, you know, so why is this one, you know, why is there a precept against doing this? Because because you deceive people. Yeah, you're deceiving people. And deceiving people regarding the Dharma is the worst kind of deception. Because if you make claims to have realized something and then you fall flat on your face and all these people lose faith, they could, in you, they could also lose faith in the Dharma. And if you do things that make people lose faith in the Dharma, that adversely affects them for many, 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 many lifetimes. Yeah. So it's something that you really don't want to do. Mm-hmm. Okay. And also, you know, if you get self-inflated like this, or if you, you know, you start thinking maybe you have these realizations, or even you know you don't, you pretend like you do because the disciples want you to, you know? Because disciples can put a lot of pressure on a teacher to act in a certain way, you know? And the disciples want you to look holy, so you look holy, and then you put on this thing that you have, you know, some high realizations, then the disciples, they love it. You know, they're really impressed because they want to be the student of some far out somebody. Yeah. And then afterwards, I mean, we've seen with various scandals, somebody falls flat on their face. Then a lot of people get very hurt spiritually because of it. Yeah. And that's really the worst way of hurting somebody. Somebody could think, you know, breaking up a love relationship is the worst way to hurt somebody. No, that is not going to influence you for many, many lifetimes the way harming somebody spiritually would. Yeah. And then it harms yourself as well. If you start thinking you're hot toast, you know, then, yeah, then, what, you know, I mean, then, I don't need to practice anymore because I have realizations, so I don't need to practice. Yeah.
So you spend your life deceiving yourself and others, gaining a lot of fame and fortune and notoriety at the time of death. And then where from there? Does that really cast you out of ever having the Dharma in your life in a sincere way, or is it even more serious than
well,
that?
Well, I think it's been quite a while in the hell realm. And then maybe, you know, maybe you created some virtuous karma too. You know, probably did somewhere along the path. And, you know, some, you've been seeing holy objects and there's something, so that could cause a rebirth later on, but yeah, I think it would be quite bad for one's own future rebirth, actually. Okay, but it's really true when you look, sometimes the pressure from the disciples is tremendous on some teachers. Yeah, because they really want, yeah, anyway.
It reminds me of the Wizard of Oz, and like, you know, the citizens just want to perpetuate that because they...
The citizens of Oz wanted the wizard, didn't they? Yeah? Yeah, I forgot how did he get to Oz? But a balloon? Oh, yeah, and then they thought he was wonderful, and so he set up this whole thing, you know, with his... Yeah? And pretended to be a wizard, yeah, really, because they wanted that. Yeah. Okay, number 16. Taking gifts from others who were encouraged to give you things originally intended as offerings to the Three Jewels. Not giving things to the Three Jewels that others have given you to give to them. Or accepting property stolen from the Three Jewels. Okay, so this is directly or indirectly acquiring the property of the Three Jewels. Okay, so taking gifts from others who were encouraged to give you things originally intended as offerings to the Three Jewels. So somebody is intending to make an offering to the temple. Yeah. And you say, oh, I really, and you know it, that they're going to offer to the temple. And you say, I really want to do retreat. I haven't done retreat in so long. And, you know, I'm not sure where I'm going to go because I would really like to build a retreat house. And I don't have the money to do that. And then the person says, oh, they think, oh, well, instead of giving the money to the temple, I'll give it to this person. In the person's mind, they had already dedicated the money for the temple. But, you know, due to our smooth talking, then they change their mind and they give the money to us instead. Okay? So they say, you know, when you've decided to give something to someone, kind of it really isn't yours after that point. Yeah. So sometimes you have to say to yourself, I think I'm going to give this to someone, if you think that you might change your mind somewhere in there. Yeah? But if you kind of, you know, if the donor is sure that they're going to give it and then they change their mind, it's negative karma for them and it's negative karma for you for making them change their mind and giving it to you. So there's one of the Bhikshuni and Bhikshu precepts that is, you know, some that are similar to that. Okay? Then not giving things to the Three Jewels that others have given you to give to them. So you're going to Bodh Gaya, and so your friends in the States give you money and say, please, you know, will you make offerings at the Bodh Gaya stupa, if you go to Nalanda, make offerings there, go make offerings at Sarnath for me, you know, just buy some candles or some incense or put it in the Dana box there, but make offerings for me on this holy place. So they give you money, you go on your pilgrimage, and you know, then you have this money, and then you see maybe a beggar. And you think, oh, I should give the money to the beggar. Or maybe you see another fellow traveler who's just run out of money and you think, oh, I should give the money to that person. Or maybe, you know, you want a really, really nice meal, you know, after eating Dalbat. Yeah. So you're tired of eating dalba. You want a really nice meal, so you use the money that somebody gave you that was meant for the Three Jewels. Yeah. Or maybe somebody gives you, you know, you're going to the Dharma Center or something, and somebody gives you a box of cookies or some food and says, please make offerings at the Dharma Center for this, put it on the offer, on the, you know, on the altar, or you're going to a temple, you know, to a monastery, give it to the Sangha. And on your way there, then, you know, you have a flat tire and you're waiting on the highway and you're hungry and you think, well, I'll eat that and then I'll buy something else that I give to the temple. No, because the person had dedicated that specific box, you know, for it. I think in terms of money, you don't have to give the specific bills, yeah, because it's the value of the money that's important. And certainly if you're going from one country to the other, you'll be changing money, yeah. But if it's a material thing, then you should give that exact thing that somebody gave you to give to the three jewels, you know, and not give it to someone else. And if you know that something was meant for the three jewels and somebody's giving it to you, you know, then don't accept it and say, please use that to make offerings. Yeah?
Well, I do feel uneasy if somebody gives me money. Mm-hmm. I do feel uneasy if somebody gives me money to offer and then, like, if I lump it together with my own funds when I change money, mm-hmm. then it does strange things to my mind. Like, you know, I would designate this is given to me for offering by somebody else, and then when I change money, that becomes that piece.
Right, that amount becomes, you keep it separate from your own
money. Yeah, it's very difficult for me to lump it and exchange the money together.
Yeah, you might change the money together, but then you sit down and figure out what proportion of it is your money and what proportion was given to the three jewels, and then you separate that out and keep it in a different envelope.
Yeah, sometimes to the extent that I can't quite put them together to exchange in a lump.
You can't lump the three, exchange.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, that's okay. If you exchange them separately, too, that's fine.
The mind doesn't quite like when it's messy for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Whatever is easier for you, do that. Yeah, the important thing is to make sure that donations go where they were meant. Yeah, and the same thing, even if somebody gives you a donation for, you know, Save the Children, then you should give that donation to Save the Children. You don't give it to some other charity or keep it for yourself or something like that. If, you know, Save the Children ran out of business or went out of business and so you couldn't give it to them, then you would give it to a similar one, but tell the person, you know, or write them beforehand and say, can I do that? Yeah. So it's always good whenever you're uncertain, you know, regarding a benefactor, then to contact the benefactor. Yeah. And ask. There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. We've done it sometimes here. Yeah. So, I mean, it shows integrity on your part that you're not. Yeah. Okay. Then another example they give is fining monastics. Yeah. So, stealing from monastics actually comes under number 5. Yeah. So if a minister or somebody in the government, if they put fines on 4 or more fully ordained people, then it would be number 5. And here is if it's 1, 2, or 3 monastics. Yeah, because you need the 4 or more to become a Sangha. Okay, so, you know, also I didn't do the last phrase, accepting property stolen from the three jewels. So if you suspect that something's been stolen from the three jewels, either don't accept it or accept it and then try and return it. So this, you know, like, you know, when the communists went through Tibet and China and ransacked temples, and then you found incredible holy objects on the market being sold in Hong Kong that had been stolen actually from the temples in Tibet and China. Yeah. So those kind of things you would not buy, or if you bought them, you would take them back to the monastery where they came from and offer them back to the monastery there. Yeah. Or if somebody gives you something that was stolen from the Three Jewels, again, not keeping it, but trying to give it back in some way or another. Then, anything else about that one?
What about those stuff that are now in a lot of the museums that have been taken, you know, during the colonial times?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah.
And if you are working there, and you have the Bodhisattva vows.
Yeah.
Does that hurt
you? Well, if you were the one acquiring these things that were taken during colonial times, then, you know, if you were a Buddhist and you had the Bodhisattva ethical restraints, you would be breaking it, yeah, in this way. You know, so much of this, like when they found different things at Dunhuang, and I mean, the Brits took a lot of stuff. And, you know, are they stealing that from the Three Jewels? Because there weren't really temples there, you know, it was all runes, and they took things from runes. So they may be stealing from the government, yeah. And I know in some cases the government had, you know, governments in India and China have asked these museums to repatriate the things that were taken during colonial times. Yeah. And I think they should. It actually belongs to that country. On the other hand, if you were in Afghanistan and you knew the Taliban was going to destroy these things, then, you know, if you took them out with a motivation to protect them and to protect Taliban people from creating so much negative karma, then that, I think, would be positive. Yeah. Yeah, there were some people, you know, I know when the communists overran Tibet, that really tried to take statues and texts, especially texts, out. But many times they were probably their own texts, or they were monks from that monastery, and so on behalf of that monastery, they would take the texts out to preserve them. Yeah, and they did a great service, because otherwise these things would have gone up in fire. Yeah, it's quite amazing when you go to those places and you see where people have... you know, both in Tibet and China, where they've you just see broken parts of statues and parts of texts lying around. And yeah, and it's really an awful, awful feeling to see that, just all this rubble, and dispersed in the rubble are parts of holy objects and parts of holy texts. Yeah. So you can only imagine the karma that those people create. Okay, then 17. This one has a few parts too. So causing those engaged in serenity meditation to give it up by giving their belongings to those who are merely reciting texts, or making bad disciplinary rules that cause a spiritual community not to be in harmony. So if you commit one or the other, it's a transgression. So causing those engaged in, you know, some in serenity meditation, somebody is meditating, trying to gain serenity, so they're working hard at that and staying in a retreat situation so that they don't have so much distraction. But your friend is reciting texts, and you would really like to, you know, your friend who's reciting texts, to get the donations and things. So you take things that were meant for or already possessed by the people doing retreat, and you give them to people who are, reciting texts or something like that. So that is, not so good to do, because the people who are doing retreat and trying to actualize serenity are doing some really useful meditation that will, really further them along the path. People who are reciting texts, that's very good, that's virtuous, but the people who are really trying to put things into practice by meditation, are doing something more intense. And also those people in retreat have a harder time getting requisites. The people who are reciting texts in town have an easier time getting requisites. So taking things from the people doing retreat and then giving them to other people who aren't in retreat. Okay, or the other part. So the part B could be either maybe you're somebody in the monastic community, or maybe you're a government employee, but so you're making laws. The government makes laws that cause a monastic community to be in harmony, or maybe somebody in the community itself who has some power makes some kind of law or rule within the monastery that causes a lot of friction. So it would be, for example, during the Cultural Revolution, if somebody were a Buddhist and had these precepts, going into a monastery and saying the monastics can't study and meditate anymore, they have to go to communist propaganda courses and learn propaganda. Yeah, that kind of thing. Or, what is another example is at Larangar, in this monastery in the high Sichuan province, the government is being quite hard on them. And I saw one picture, because what is true is that there is a definite fire hazard there, because the people are living very close to each other in wooden buildings. There's been ravaging fires before. And so there is reason, in one way to tear down some of the buildings and do things different. But some of those monastics are having to leave and go back to the temples where they started out from. But I saw one picture of a bunch of nuns. They were in work clothes, lined up, and they were reciting communist propaganda things. That's what the government had made them do after they left the monastery. So, that's causing the community to be disharmonious, and it's really interfering with people's spiritual practice. So that's creating a lot of negative karma. Okay, so making some disciplinary rule, like if somebody here said, okay, nobody can study and meditate, everybody has to go and get a job in town, because we need more money, so everybody has to go and get a job in town. Well, that's not going to be so good. Yeah, so we're talking about rules like that, not rules like, from now on, we're not going to have junk food in the kitchen. That might cause more disharmony than anything else. No more junk food. But that's something that could be protecting the monastics and extending their lifespan. So, maybe we need an executive order like that. Except the kind of junk food I like, which is not junk food. It's actually good for you. Yeah? Okay. And then number 18, abandoning the two bodhicittas. So here it means aspiring bodhicitta and engaging bodhicitta. Okay. Yeah.
I've never been able to understand why these two, 17A and B, are under the same number, the the relationship between the two.
Between the two, because they're both interfering with people's Dharma practice. One is by taking their requisites, the other is by making bad rules. Yeah? So people who are really trying to practice and you're causing them problems. Okay. So regarding these 18, to have a full transgression of 16, you need four binding factors. But for two of them, you don't need these four binding factors. Just by having the thought in your mind is sufficient for a root transgression. So those two are holding wrong views. Okay, saying the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha don't exist. Enlightenment doesn't exist. It's impossible. Cause and effect don't exist. These kinds of things. So that one, so just even thinking that, holding those kind of wrong views, you know, you don't need these four binding factors. And same for giving up bodhicitta, either giving up aspiring or engaging bodhicitta. Yeah, so just the thought of, you know, I'm done with this bodhisattva stuff or whatever it is, you know. I'm sick and tired of sentient beings.
Yeah. This sine qua non of the bodhisattva vows, though, I mean.
Yeah, if with both of those, if you have wrong views and if you give up bodhicitta, then having the bodhisattva vows doesn't make any sense for you at all, does it? So before I go into the four, are there questions? Any other questions or points?
Can you do that while still having bodhicitta? Kind of just seems like you couldn't still be holding bodhicitta and still do that.
Yeah, you could have bodhicitta, but you could say to somebody else, oh, you're not really bodhisattva material. Yeah. You're too selfish, or you're too dumb, or you're too whatever, you know, so discouraging somebody from that. But thinking that you're quite okay for practicing bodhicitta. Huh? I mean, you could, let's say you see somebody who's really, really struggling, yeah? They took the bodhisattva precepts, they're really struggling, they're unhappy, yeah, because they're sitting there blaming themselves, oh, I am so selfish, and I can't keep these precepts very well. And so maybe out of what you think is compassion, you say to them, oh, it's okay, you know, just ignore that you took them. You know, Mahayana's not for you. You can give it up. Yeah? And you think that you're being very kind, helping that person to not be so stressed out. Yeah? But not so smart. Yeah? Yeah, it's amazing when you really think about it, the number of things that we can do that are non-virtuous, that we do with the thought, thinking that we're helping somebody. Yeah? So when you see things like that, you know how when they talk about like the 10 non-virtues, you can do any of them motivated by any of the three poisons. So then you begin to understand how you could do these negative actions motivated by ignorance. Yeah, because you really think, oh, what I'm doing is virtuous. Yeah, and so you ignorantly give people very bad advice or do things yourself that you think is virtuous. Yeah? Like, oh, all these prostitutes, they would benefit so much from learning the Dharma. They would have so much self-respect, you know, if they met somebody, you know, who really cared for them. And so I'm going to go work in a brothel and just be one of the girls and, you know, and share the Dharma with them to help them get out of that life. No? So We shake our head, but let me tell you, I mean, I've met people who've done amazing things that they think it's so beneficial, and it's not. So. I mean, you have the men who are going to prostitutes. Of, I'm doing these girls a favor. You know, they're poor. I'm giving them some money. Yeah, so it's good. What I'm doing is good. They do something, that's okay. They're going to sleep around anyway, but I'm giving them money. And I'm kind to them. And so this is, and you know, this is compassionate. Yeah, amazing how people can think. Yeah? You think we don't, you don't make up excuses and weird motivations? Yeah, maybe I should point them out to you sometimes when you say them to me. No, but in the actual moment, yeah, so that you can get really mad at me. And what are you saying? I don't do that. Yeah. Okay, so then the four. Okay, this is the four binding factors. So the first one is not regarding your action as destructive. So you don't even know that you're transgressing a bodhisattva vow, or you're not, even if you don't know that it's a bodhisattva vow, you're not regarding what you're doing as destructive, as harmful. Or even you recognize that the action is transgressing a bodhisattva vow, you don't care. Yeah, it's like, this just a little transgression, you know, and I really want to do this. And, you know, my teacher told me to relax and to, you know, not be so hard on myself and to have some empathy for myself. So, yeah, this isn't really a transgression. Okay, so that kind of thing. And then not abandoning the thought to do the action again, so you've done it, and you have no thought to stop doing it in the future. And that goes along with number three, is that you're happy and you're rejoicing you did it. You know? I had such a good meal. You know, my friend gave me some money to make us an offering, and I had this, you know, anyway, the gate was closed when I went to make the offering, so I used the money for a really good meal, and I really needed a good meal, and my friend, I know that they'll be really happy, you know. So that's fine what I did, no regret doing it, happy to do it again. And then for not having a sense of integrity or consideration for others regarding what you have done. So these two mental factors, yeah, integrity, so it's abandoning non-virtue out of your own self-respect. You know, I don't want to be the kind of person that does that, or I have precepts, my dharma practice is like this, I can't do that. Yeah, so that would be integrity. Or consideration for others is thinking of the adverse effect your action would have on somebody else, making them lose faith in the Dharma, making them lose faith in you as a practitioner. I've heard there's also, I think in the Pali system, they talk about this one in a slightly different way, which is being afraid of being criticized by the wise. You know, I'm not sure if they give it the same name or if they're talking about another mental factor, but there's also that one, that you abandon something out of respect for people who are wiser than you, and you don't want them to criticize you. So that would actually fit in there with, you know, consideration for others, because, you know, you think, you know, what would happen if my teacher showed up right now? Uh, Yeah, no, I wasn't drinking. I was just talking with the people here. You know, you hide your bottle of booze or you, whatever. You know, you have your arm around somebody and you quickly take it off. Okay. Okay. So, you know, if we have those to have a complete transgression of the other 16, you need all four of those. Within, there's sometimes talk of, you know, like within how much time do you have before you abandon the thought, you know? Like maybe immediately you don't abandon the thought of doing it again, and maybe immediately you feel quite happy about having done it, but maybe an hour later then your mind has realized what you've done, or maybe a day later or a month later. So has it been a full transgression if you later come to lack these different factors? So I forget what it is. It might be that I should really look that up. So somehow 3 hours is sticking in my mind, you know, like 3-4 hours. But I'm not sure. So not very long meaning.
I don't remember what it was, but it wasn't like tomorrow.
Yeah. Yo, no, it's definitely not. Yeah. It's definitely not tomorrow or next month. No, definitely not that. I can't remember if it's like immediate or like 3-4 hours, something like that, or half an hour, whatever. Yeah. Okay. Of course, you know, if you later come to regret it, that regret is good because that will motivate you to do purification. So, you know, don't think, oh, I'm too late to regret it and not have it be a full transgression. So I just won't regret it then. No, that thinking like that's rather dumb. Okay. And so then to purify, you know, 35 Buddhas is very good. Vajrasattva is also very good. And then to take the Bodhisattva ethical restraints again, either from a teacher, or you can, you know, if you visualize the Buddha, or you have a Buddha statue. And so thinking that the Buddha statue is the actual Buddha, then you retake it, you know, you make the pledge again. Okay. And actually we should be taking the Bodhisattva ethical restraints, if you have them, 3 times in the morning, 3 times in the evening. It's included in the Six-Session Guru Yoga. So
these 4 factors
uh-huh.
sound a lot like the factors for any kind of transaction, you know, but non-virtuous action.
No, you know, with other things, just doing the action is, you know, it's a complete action.
I just thought there was something about enjoying having done it or something.
Yeah, complete karma. Yeah, but it's just the fourth one, the completion, is you've done the action and, you know, you feel satisfied with it. If by the time the action is complete you feel regret, then that's, you know, that's not the case. But yeah. But in other things, I mean, these, for any negative action, you definitely don't want to have these 4 with you. But it's not that, let's say, with your pratimoksha precepts that you need these 4 to break it. Yeah? You getting what I'm saying? Okay. Usually they, you know, that... Usually, if you look at the state of your mind, yeah, it's very often with these 4 there, but they aren't included as factors for a complete transgression. Okay.
So if somebody holds these vows, they go over them 3 times in the morning and 3 times in the
evening? Oh, no, you take them. you like, you know, you make the bodhisattva promise. Like, you know, when we say, by the merit I create, by practicing generosity and the other far-reaching attitudes, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings, that's can be considered taking the bodhisattva vow. So, you know, you do that three times a day. Yeah, so it could be that. There's a verse in Shantideva's text that, you know, is included in, like, Succession Guru Yoga that you recite. There's different ones. Yeah.
Which is part of our practice, anyways.
Huh?
Which is part of our practice here.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
What about a case? It's kind of indirect. I think the, which number was it? Taking properties from Dhamma, from the three jewels, and hearing about several cases actually where people stole from the offices, and it might have been overnight, and so then there was made the decision, okay, not to keep any money outside, you know, to take it with you, bring it to the bank immediately in the afternoons. And if you don't do it, then you're kind of risking that the money that is dedicated to the Dhamma or to the three jewels is being taken.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, places that where they get a lot of offerings, you definitely don't want to leave all that money around because it's very tempting for people. We've had a couple of cases here where people have taken things from the Dana basket. And books, library books, yeah. So many library books have gotten lost.
What is the name of our new monastic and what does her name mean?
Ah!
My friends online are rejoicing.
Come stand up here so people can see you.
Hi. My name is Tupten Nima. And it means sunshine.
Nima means sunshine, and Tupten.
And Tupten means the able one.
Able one's teachings.
Able one's teachings.
The Buddha's teachings.
Yes.